This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, hurricane season hits hard. Some of the worst devastation is in Haiti.
One young boy wearing boots four sizes too big sloshes knee-deep in water, holding a little dog in a burlap sack.
Plus, a different kind of travel insurance for the trip from Pakistan to Afghanistan.
A few days ago, two women stopped me to have their car smoked. They were going to be driving in a dangerous area and wanted protection. So I smoked their car and they gave me 200 rupees.
And bringing home the beat of Brazil's favelas. All that's ahead. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Three huge storms have hit the tiny Caribbean country of Haiti in the last 2 weeks. 300 people lost their lives. Tens of thousands have lost their homes. Rescue workers struggle to reach the flood victims, often without success. Reporter Amelia Shaw visited one of the worst-hit regions. She sent us this reporter's notebook.
I'm flying by UN helicopter to the flood-ravaged city of Gonaïves in northern Haiti. I can see from the window that floodwaters still cover more than half of this city of 300,000 people. The only way in and out is by air or sea. All the bridges into the region have been washed away, making access by road impossible. When we land, we head to the UN military base. Peacekeepers have been assigned here since 2004. Now it's filled with aid workers from big organizations like CARE and Caritas. They're planning how to get food into the large slum area called Jubilee. Jubilee is still underwater. Most people there have had nothing to eat for days. We travel by convoy through the city. The main roads are shallow rivers. Water in some places is 3 feet deep. Hundreds of people wade through it carrying the debris of their lives. A bucket of clothes, a bicycle, some dining room chairs. One young boy wearing boots four sizes too big sloshes knee-deep in water, holding a little dog in a burlap sack. We pass overturned cars, cement shacks reduced to rubble, a bus standing upright at 45 degrees. On the building still standing, the waterline makes a long streak of mud on the walls. It's more than 8 feet high. Many people are still living on the roof of their homes, afraid to come down. One family crouches on a mattress in the sun, surrounded by the few bags of rice they could pull from their home below. Outside Jubilee School, some men are shoveling through a muddy quagmire. Where the floodwaters have receded, thick tracks of sludge remain, putrid and deep. A small girl in a torn pink dress is up to her calves in mud. She tugs insistently at her flip-flops, which are stuck. The school is being used as a temporary shelter for people who have lost their homes. Nearly 1,000 people are already waiting here, in the hopes of getting a day's ration of protein biscuits and water. Hundreds more crowd the gates outside, yelling to be let in. The air is charged with tension. These people have been waiting for hours. Some have not eaten in days. Most are desperate for a drink of water. A woman holds a small boy who looks wilted in the hot sun. His eyes are barely open. He is so hungry and dehydrated. She screams to be given some food as others just stare blankly on. A man next to me says he lost his mother in the floods. It's just God's will, he says, and shrugs. His eyes are blank and vacant. The food truck finally arrives and backs into the schoolyard under the tight guard of a few dozen peacekeepers who are so muddy that even their weapons are brown and slick. They stand impassive, a wall between the flood victims and the aid workers who are unloading their precious cargo. Without the soldiers, complete chaos would reign. 9 people have allegedly died after being trampled in food relief lines. It's a heart-wrenching job, to keep a starving crowd from ransacking supplies. People outside the school begin climbing the roof to get inside the schoolyard. The crowd surges forward, their eyes red from anger and despair. Peacekeepers push them back, struggling to keep order. An aid worker shakes her head, near tears. "There's just not enough food for everyone," she says. As the peacekeepers struggle to hold the line, relief teams work harder to hand out food faster. But in the end, all they can do is give out everything they have today and hope for more help tomorrow.
Amelia Shaw is a freelance reporter based in Haiti. The yellow buses are back on the road here at home, and kids are getting used to new schedules and new teachers. That's not true for kids in rural Mexico. They often walk 2 hours to get to school, and they're not sure what or who they'll find once they get there. Conrad Fox reports from Veracruz State, Mexico.
Noé Tapia is a 15-year-old student at a school in the remote mountain village of Misantla. His grades are slipping, but he says it's not because he skips classes. It's because his teachers do.
They're pretty much all the same. None of them arrive on time. They always say they've got paperwork to do or something. There's some who don't get here until Wednesday at 1 in the afternoon.
The teachers live in Misantla only on weekdays. On weekends, like most teachers in Mexico's distant rural schools, they head back to their homes in urban centers hours away. Most of them, say students and parents here, don't roll in again until late on Monday afternoon and disappear early on Friday. When they are in the classroom, says Noé, not all of them are exemplary educators.
One teacher, he'd beat you if you didn't know your times tables. A couple of kids knocked over a desk once and he beat them with a stick. And then that broke and he took out his belt and beat them with it. And he'd get drunk and pee in the classroom. We didn't like to go. The classroom stunk.
Not surprisingly, parents are incensed over the quality of education here. But, they say, authorities have not heeded their complaints. When the school principal refused to fire the teacher that beat Noé's classmates, they had to band together and take away the teacher's key to the school before he would leave. Noé's father, Leoncio Tapia, blames the union for protecting negligent teachers.
Su sindicato de los maestros los apoya mucho. Ellos se sienten...
The union backs them up in everything. There's no punishment. You can't tell them anything. Teachers go around like kings. They tell us that because they're in the union, they can't do anything.
Tapia isn't the only one to make that complaint. With 1.5 million members, the Mexican Teachers Union has a long history as a powerful player in Mexican politics. And many critics say it uses that power to coddle poor teachers.
El sindicato es en alguna manera juez y parte de las decisiones.
It's like a judge and jury. It decides who gets a job and where they are going to work. And when teachers don't turn up, absolutely nothing happens. If a teacher is reported, they go to the union, and the union justifies their absence.
Oralia Bonilla is a researcher working with the Organization of Ibero-American States, a multi-government development organization in Latin America. She says she's seen hundreds of classrooms like Noé's, where absenteeism, abuse of authority, and lackadaisical teaching are hurting students. The worst cases, she says, are in rural schools, where oversight is most lax.
No hay interés por el aprendizaje.
There's a lack of interest in the students to learn, she says. Test results are really low. She points to a 2006 study by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that ranked the quality of education systems around the world. Mexico placed 50th out of 57 countries. Even the World Bank has blamed the Mexican Teachers Union for what it calls very low quality of education in the country.
I don't agree with these pessimistic views on our education, that other countries come in and tell us how bad our schools are. Veracruz teachers are well trained.
Gaudencio Hernandez is head of the teachers union in Veracruz. He admits some teachers regularly miss classes, but he denies the union covers for them.
Yes, it's a problem, but that bad? No. There's a few teachers like that, but they haven't realized the union is totally against it.
But even some insiders are unhappy with the union. Take Oscar Gomez, who's been a member for 3 years.
It's a mafia, completely politicized. They tell you here you've got to make friends, make sure you fit in.
Gomez works as a school administrator, but is waiting for a teaching post. He claims that all new teachers are assigned to jobs hours or even days from their homes. Getting a better position, he says, has nothing to do with a teacher's ability or students' needs.
Eso implica que muchas veces te llevan a las campañas políticas.
They take you on their political campaigns. For example, the buddy of the general secretary will be running for mayor. So they'll take you to the paint signs, put up posters, attend rallies. And as you do more of this, the union will bring you closer and closer to your home. And you spend all your time in the classroom, not thinking about teaching, but about how you can get in with the union.
Union leader Gaudencio Hernandez denies the charge, saying long treks to work are all part of paying your dues as a new teacher.
It's the way we've always done things. The newer teachers always start further from home. When I started, I had to go an hour by train, then an hour and a half in the back of a pickup, then another hour walking, but it made us stronger.
The federal government secretary of education did not respond to a request for an interview for this story. Meanwhile, 15-year-old Noe Tapia is tired of waiting for things to change. He's become so discouraged with his school experience, he's decided to drop out. In Misantla, Mexico, I'm Conrad Fox for the World Vision Report.
This story continues to develop. A few weeks ago, the government and the National Teachers Union agreed that teachers will no longer be able to pass their teaching post on to a child. Now, only those who pass a competitive exam will be offered a teaching position. The goal is to improve the quality of education and eliminate some of the corruption within the education department. Teachers in several cities have staged strikes and protest marches against this new regulation. In Jordan, thousands of Iraqi kids are going back to school after a very long break. Here's our globe at a glance. For years, children of Iraqi refugees in Jordan weren't allowed to attend public school unless they had proper immigration documents. Three-quarters of the refugees did not qualify. That left thousands of Iraqi children without education. Under pressure from aid organizations, the Jordanian government decided last year to allow Iraqi children to attend state schools despite their immigration status. But school fees and the rising cost of living still kept kids at home. Now the government of Jordan has stepped in again. Just in time for the new school year, it announced that all Iraqi children could attend state-owned schools for free. And that's our globe at a glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Still to come, when drumming is your day job. That's ahead on the World Vision Report after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. In the United States, patients who are in pain can get morphine to ease their suffering. But in the developing world, few patients have access to the pain-killing drug. Sierra Leone is no exception. Many sick people there have nothing to relieve their pain. Grant Fuller reports.
Nine-year-old Fatmata Jallo cries out in agony as a nurse injects her with a painkiller. The skin on Fatmata's entire left leg is long gone. It's been eaten away by a bacterial condition called septicemia, as well as gangrene. The infection began 5 months prior when Fatmata fell and her mother applied traditional herbs to the wound. By the time they made it to this hospital in northern Sierra Leone, the bacteria was spreading and the pain quickly became unbearable. Fatmata Tibanga is the girl's mother.
They cry a lot when the pain is.
She cries a lot when the pain is there. She cries a lot. In fact, it's even made her unable to eat now. If I give her food, she eats and then she vomits.
Ms. Tibanga sits next to her daughter's metal bed in the crowded children's ward and grinds aspirin tablets. She mixes them with water to give Fatmata through a feeding tube, a supplement to her three daily injections of tramadol. A moderate painkiller, tramadol is only 10% as potent as morphine. medical assistant ABD Cisse explains.
For sure, Tramadol, which is readily available, has minimal pain relieving effect. So I believe people are suffering from pain unduly because the appropriate drug that can help them is not there.
That appropriate drug is morphine. Most hospitals in Sierra Leone don't have any. This hospital actually does have a very limited supply of 70 ampules, or small vials.
That is not sufficient if you really want to use morphine on a more regular basis. In 70 ampules, if you have a patient that is terminally ill, maybe you might need two or three ampules per day. So you can only use it for severe emergencies only.
Fatmata gets impatient with her mom's constant questions about where it hurts. Through sleepless nights and agonizing changes of her leg dressing, this little girl has endured intense pain with nothing but inadequate medicines and her mother's comfort. By the end of the day, Fatmata's health had deteriorated rapidly as the infection entered her bloodstream. The next day, she passed away. Cisse says morphine could have spared her such a painful death.
Sometimes I feel like crying because here is a beautiful girl, very intelligent, somebody who could be a future figure for this country. Seeing her dying, it is very, very painful.
So why isn't morphine available in Sierra Leone for those who need it? Officials admit that until recently, orders for the drug often ended up in the hands of the government or the military. Also, the country is still recovering from a decade-long civil war in which drugged-up kids became killing machines. That experience has left a widespread fear of drug abuse. Despite all this, the country's pharmacy board decided 2 years ago to relax importation policies on morphine. Jack Lansana of the pharmacy board explains.
My job is to make sure that it's available when requested for. We have not got any application so far that we have not given approval for.
But there's one big problem with this new development. The agency never told anyone about it. Only a few foreign relief organizations heard of the change and received permits. Most hospitals remain largely in the dark.
There's labs in our own area, so we need to do a little bit of training for doctors to be aware now that they can have access to these things actually.
Sierra Leone's government hospitals are too cash-strapped to afford beds, much less painkillers. But many other privately funded facilities, like the hospital where Fatmata died, would be ready and able to buy morphine if they only knew they could. One medical facility that is aware of the new process is Shepherd's Hospice near the capital, Freetown. Director Gabriel Madie is a pain policy fellow with the University of Wisconsin, so he got wind of the eased restrictions through his contacts at the pharmacy board.
If by next week it cannot go through,
Today, Madie is on the phone requesting his facility's first pharmacy board permit.
We believe that debt is a necessary end. It has to come, except that we have to make sure it is a comfortable experience. And that is what morphine does for us.
The hospice has never had morphine before, and Madie is placing a large order to try and take advantage of the relaxed policy. He estimates this supply would last the hospice 3 years, but he's been told he must cut back the order to half a kilogram for fear of misuse. Madie says the risk is overstated.
You take oral morphine for pain, and the pain goes away. And so you have nothing left as a residue to trigger addiction. If you were to take morphine when you have no pain, then the body develops some desire to have it all the time. But if you take it for pain, it's just going to relieve the pain and nothing more.
For HIV-positive patients like 40-year-old Arun Bangura here at Shepherd's Hospice, the morphine would bring relief from excruciating pain.
You still get the pain?
Yeah.
A healthcare worker checks up on Bangura in a tiny room of Shepherd's Hospice. His pain today centers on a face rash caused by herpes, the latest manifestation of his virus.
The pain I'm feeling, it crosses like electric current.
The pain I'm feeling, it crosses my body like electric current. When it enters, it starts from my gums, it sticks to my eardrum, it comes to my eye before it clings to my head. At that moment, I have to hit the floor. My entire body burns like I'm on fire. I can't sleep. I've never experienced anything compared to this pain. So I'd be very happy to get pain medicine.
As Shepherd's Hospice tries to ensure a peaceful death for people with terminal diseases, Madie remains hopeful that morphine will soon make his job much easier.
The right to die without pain is a human right. And Even family members who are in pain on account of the patient in severe pain would have some relief. Now that we have an approval to get oral morphine to Sierra Leone, though we have some bureaucratic bottlenecks, but I see that as great improvement.
But recently, those bureaucratic bottlenecks got a lot tighter. Jack Lansana was quietly fired from the pharmacy board for undisclosed reasons. Lansana had been Medea's primary contact in negotiating for the morphine permit. Now, Medea has no idea when or even if the request will be approved. Meanwhile, many Sierra Leoneans continue to live and die in pain. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in McKinney, Sierra Leone.
Grant Fuller joins us now to give us an update on what's happened since he did that story. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Peggy. Great to be here.
Well, the first thing I want to know is, did Shepherd's Hospice ever get their morphine?
No, Shepherd's Hospice still has not received the morphine, but they are significantly closer than they were. Just last week, Gabriel Medea got the permit approved by the pharmacy board, finally, and they sent in the payment for the morphine to the distributor. Now he says he expects to wait about 3 weeks for the morphine to arrive.
So it's not really getting any easier for the patients at this hospice?
Well, no, it's not getting any easier yet, but I think Gabriel is hopeful that the time is very near when things will be getting much easier for them, and they will be able to relieve some of that severe pain.
How much time did you actually spend with the family that you did the story on?
I spent about 2 weeks straight visiting the hospital almost every day. And in the last week of Fatmata's life, I was there on Wednesday to observe a procedure in the operating room where they were changing her leg dressing. And then I returned on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday to try to interview her. And then she passed away, unfortunately, on Sunday.
That must have been really tough for you as a reporter to watch.
Yes, it was extremely difficult to have to witness, a little girl on her deathbed. And I was there as a journalist, but it was a difficult situation to be in, putting a bit of a strain, extra strain, on their family as they were going through this difficult time. So it was an awkward situation to be in.
I know you say it's agonizing for you, but what difference can you make as a journalist covering these kinds of stories?
That's a good question, because I don't feel like I'm making any direct difference in their lives, any direct or immediate difference. I'm not giving them money to buy the medicine. You know, I am telling them that there's this magical drug, morphine, which will make your daughter's pain so much less, but I have no means to offer that drug to them. I can't just go out and buy it for them and give it to them. And so I think it's less of a direct, real impact on the ground here, but there's a possibility this could make a difference in the future in raising awareness around the world of this critical issue.
Grant Fuller, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I came to New York City from Florida to study jazz at the New School University. My drum set teacher was Billy Hart, who's one of the greatest jazz drummers of our time.
Scott Kettner is founder of the musical group Nation Beat. When he first got to New York, he just wanted to learn how to play jazz drums. He never dreamed his teacher would send him on a musical quest 5,000 miles from home.
And so I went to his house one day and for a lesson, and I said, "Well, Billy, you know, we've been playing samba and bossa nova for a couple years now. I was wondering if there's anything else about Brazilian music. Is there another Brazilian rhythm I should be checking out?" And he's like, "Yeah, there's this other Brazilian rhythm from the northeast of Brazil called maraca too. How does it go? Here, show it to me." You know, and I pointed to the drum set for him to come play it for me. He goes, "Man, I don't know how to play it. I just know it's a bad rhythm, and you got to go learn it and come back and teach it to me."
So he did. Scott Kettner took his drum teacher literally and set off for Brazil. He ended up in a town called Recife. While he was there, he met a well-known musician named Jorge Martins. Martins ran a music school, and he took that school out into the streets of the favelas, or slums, to reach the children there.
So I was accompanying him to these favelas and assisting him while he was giving these classes, and him and I just hit it off immediately. I didn't speak any Portuguese, he couldn't speak any English, but for some reason we just had a really strong, deep connection, I think, personally and musically. So I returned to New York. I was only in Recife that first time for a week, and then I decided that I really had to go live down there. So I moved down to Brazil for a year. I spent 6 months in São Paulo and 6 months in Recife, where I lived with Jorge in a favela.
Obviously, you were learning music from him, the style of music you had come to Brazil to learn, but I'm sure you learned a lot else living in a favela.
Jorge's whole thing when he was teaching me maracatu and coco and forró and all these other rhythms from the northeast of Brazil, he really stressed the fact that this music doesn't exist without the culture. So the maracatu comes from the poor communities, comes from the favelas.
Well, so that leads me to ask, what exactly is maracatu?
It's a rhythm, it's a culture, it's a way of life. It originated approximately 400 years ago when the African slaves would have crowning ceremonies where they would crown their own king. And after that crowning ceremony, they would have a celebration where they sang songs and danced and played drums. And it was out of those celebrations that evolved what we call today maracatu.
It's like processions coming down the street. Or can you give us a picture of maracatu?
If you can picture about 150 drummers playing huge bass drums and bells and snare drums, in front of the drummers, if you picture about 200 dancers dressed up as a Portuguese monarchy, that would be what you would see in a maracatu procession.
How often does this happen? How often is there a maracatu procession in the streets?
Yeah, it usually starts to happen around carnival time. So the month of carnival is when the maracatu groups really start to rev up.
Are maracatu groups the most popular kind of music groups in northeastern Brazil?
Well, the Northeast, when we say the Northeast, each state has its own cultural manifestation. In Recife, maracatu and frevo and forró are the three really most popular styles of music.
Scott, I understand you brought an instrument with you into the studio.
Yes.
And maybe playing can help us understand even more clearly how these musical styles differ. Could you play a little maracatu for us, and then following that, a couple of these other styles?
Sure. So I've brought in here in the studio with me a pandeiro, which is a Brazilian style tambourine. And I'll play for you now a maracatu rhythm, and then I'll play a couple of other rhythms. Here's the maracatu rhythm. And then a frevo rhythm. Frevo is like an orchestra. It's like a big band. It was inspired by the swing bands from the United States that were going over there. So it's, you know, it's a big orchestra with horns, and they play really fast rhythm. And this is what the frevo rhythm would sound like on the pandeiro. And that was frevo, and then this is how a forró would sound.
Ah, okay, great. Scott, your newest album is entitled Legends of the Preacher, and maybe we could play a clip or two from there to see how this percussion works into the rest of the music, how it sounds once it's all put together. What cut would you recommend we pull to get a good picture of the maracatu?
Nago Nago would be a great example. Nosso rei que veio de Minas, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nosso rei que veio de Minas, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nosso rei que veio de Minas, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nosso rei que veio de Minas, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nago Nago Nago, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nago Nago.
That is really nice. Did I hear fiddles there?
Yeah, so what you're hearing is our interpretation of maracatu. That was a maracatu rhythm, you know, with a blues progression on top of it.
Your band blends this Brazilian music with also American music, like New Orleans jazz. How would you describe your music and what you've done with the music you've pulled up from Brazil?
I would describe it as Brazilian honky-tonk.
That sounded what we just heard, like Brazilian honky-tonk.
Yeah, pretty much.
And I know your heart is still there in the favelas in a way, and I hear you are giving 10% of your proceeds from your album back to the children in the favelas. Tell us a little about that.
Our record label, Modiba, they're a very socially conscious label. They have this project where they set aside 10% of the sales of our CDs to go back into the community from where this music is coming from. And it's always been a big thing for me to give back to the community that gave me so much.
And what exactly does it go to?
For the past 5 years, I've been conducting a cultural exchange program on my own together with my teacher, Georgie. Our donations go to Georgie's school to help him continue adopting children from the streets into his school, for him to give percussion classes, Portuguese classes, math classes, and bring the kids to museums. One of the kids is right now on tour in Europe for the past 3 months. She's been touring Europe.
But what's she like? What's her life like?
Her life is very difficult. Her father's in jail for drug trafficking. I think her mother was a prostitute. Her brothers would beat her up. She had a really difficult situation, and I love going back to see her and to see her grow and to see her just, you know, get out of that situation that she was almost doomed for.
Mm. And you stay in close touch with your teacher, Georgie. In fact, I understand he wrote some of the music on this latest album. I'd like to play one of the songs that he wrote. Which one would you suggest?
Yeah, let's play Salve Zay. That's a song that him and our singer Liliana wrote together, and he's featured on the percussion. You'll hear him on all of the percussion instruments on this track.
Salve Zay, Salve Zay.
Scott Kettner, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Coming up, it takes a village. You've heard that from Hillary Clinton and others. Now we'll hear what it means to one Nairobi man. Next on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. Today, we're introducing something new on our show. We're calling it Let's Talk. We'll be chatting with ordinary folks in the developing world to find out what's happening on their street that week. You'll meet shopkeepers, teachers, and journalists, and they'll give us a glimpse into everyday life, what's going on behind the headlines. So right now, let's talk with Ernest Waiteto. He's a journalist who lives in Nairobi, Kenya. Welcome, Ernest.
Thank you.
You left your home to come and work and study in the U.S. for 5 years. What's it like to be back now?
There's what I would call reverse culture shock, because when you've been away for that long, you sort of forget for some time what used to go on there, like the laid-back nature that you find here, so that something takes quite some time. You are going to an office in Nairobi, you find that things don't move quite as fast as they would have moved in the U.S. You have to get used to, you know, waiting a little longer for a service in a government office, or even, in a hotel when somebody is attending to you.
It was probably like that when you lived there before, right? And you had just gotten so used to life in the U.S. that you weren't accustomed to it.
They were like that. But you see, when you are away for 5 years, and so you tend to forget how fast or how slow things can move. I remember we used to say in the U.S., you wait for 10 minutes and then you realize this person is not going to show up. But here, it's not until it's 1 hour past.
1 hour?
Yes, at least an hour. You have to wait for at least an hour before you can even start thinking about moving on to something else.
You didn't actually originally come from Nairobi. You lived in a village about 100 miles away from there. And I assume you've been home to see your family in your village. What was that like returning home after so many years away?
That was very emotional for me. And it was very emotional, particularly with my grandmother, who was always very close to me before I left. My grandmother is 84 years old, and I kept telling myself that I'm hoping to God that my grandmother will be alive when I come back. Now, 5 years later, I'm coming home, and my grandmother is there to receive me. The moment I set my eyes on my grandmother, tears just started rolling down my face because it was so emotional to imagine that, you know, it's like my grandmother is still here to receive me. And of course, beyond my grandmother, when you grow up in Africa or in Kenya, especially in the village where I grew up, you realize that everything is a community affair. The community takes you to school. Like if you do not have money to pay tuition, the village comes together, raises some money, and sends you to school. It takes a village.
Oh, that's where that term comes from. It really does take a village then.
Yes, that's what happened to me. And I remember one time I did not have tuition fee, and my village actually came together, collected a few coins here, a few coins there, and sent me back to school with fees, and I was able to go through my high school like that.
So you got your graduate degree in journalism in Ohio, and now you're using it back in Kenya. You've come home. Your village must be very proud of you.
They are very, very proud. You cannot imagine it. And, you know, you meet old men and women in the village, just the pride they have in you going to study and finishing your degree and coming back home, because some people don't come back home after getting trained in places like U.S.
Ernest, why did you come back home?
I came back home because my village, my country, and in general, Africa needs me more than the U.S. needs me.
So what are you doing there now?
Right now, I'm doing freelance work and writing stories and placing them with different media organizations, some in Kenya and some international. And I'm telling a lot of stories about Kenya and about Africa. I'm also editing africanews.org, which is my own website, an online magazine, and telling a lot of stories about Africa that have not been well told.
Thank you, Ernest.
Okay, bye-bye.
We'll talk with Ernest Waiteto again soon. We hope you'll get to know him along with us and learn a little about life in Nairobi, Kenya. Next week, 20,000 people will get together in Massachusetts for the 22nd annual Farm Aid concert. They'll hear lots of different bands, including Nation Beat, the band we featured a little earlier in the show. The Farm Aid concert raises money to support family farmers. It can be tough making a living as a farmer. A bad season or an unexpected crisis can force you off your land. Each year, thousands have to give up farming because they can't make ends meet. Enter airline pilot Bill Gross. He decided to help. The result? A group of volunteers called Farm Rescue.
I came from a family farm in rural North Dakota, and I've seen over the years when I was younger and now even more so that there's fewer family farms and less children on those farms nowadays, and when a major injury, illness, or natural disaster strikes, it's harder for those neighbors to help one another. And so I thought there should be a formal nonprofit organization to help family farmers.
What kinds of farms and farmers are you really trying to rescue?
Well, we help the small to medium farmers, what we call the family farmers. And these farmers have had a variety of injuries or illnesses or natural disasters occur. Everything from maybe a severed arm or a heart transplant, liver, kidney problems. Farming is a very dangerous occupation, and there's a lot of need for this.
So mostly you're talking about farmers who are ill or injured. You're not talking necessarily about tornadoes or floods or the kinds of things that damage the farm, but the farmer himself.
Predominantly, yes, and a small 10% are natural disasters. We have helped a few families where a tornado has destroyed their farmstead completely.
Tell me a little bit about that. What happens normally? What happens when a farmer gets ill or sick or has surgery?
For a farmer, it's very serious when you become ill or injured. There is no one to do the work, and you do not have such things as sick time or disability, and many farmers do not even have medical insurance. And so when it's the time of the year to plant your crop or harvest your crop, and if you're unable to do that, it can completely destroy a farm family's livelihood.
So let's talk about how your organization, Farm Rescue, works. How do you get connected in the first place?
Well, primarily people hear about Farm Rescue, and it's either the farm family themselves or neighbors call in and tell us that this crisis has happened for this family and that they really could use some assistance.
Once you make that contact and you determine that this farmer really is in need, what is it that your organization does for them?
We come in at Farm Rescue once they're approved, and we plant or harvest their crop absolutely free of charge. There is no catches. We bring in equipment, and we bring in manpower, volunteers. We are a volunteer-run organization, and we get the work done.
And we actually have one such farmer on the phone with us now, Lowell Hartvigsen. Lowell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by telling us where you're speaking to us from.
Well, I am presently at the family farm in north central North Dakota.
What do you farm there?
We farm about 1,200 acres of tillable land. So we do small grains, and we also have livestock operation.
How did you get involved with Farm Rescue?
I had just recently gone through a serious accident. Where I lost my right arm.
Oh, my goodness.
In a baler accident.
Can you describe that, if you don't mind?
Yes, that's fine. It's a baler makes the large round bales in the hay field, and it happened to be the last bale of the year, and I was working at night, and I reached down to brush some hay off the end or outside of the baler, and I'm not sure if my sleeve got caught or hay caught my sleeve or what, but anyway, it pulled my hand into a chain and sprocket.
Oh, my goodness. Lowell, when was this?
Well, this was September 29th of 2005, and at that time, I was 8 miles from home, and of course, farmers work alone. I had a cell phone with me, and I had one bar left on the power on my phone, and I made a phone call for my wife. Lady answered, and I thought it was Debbie, but as I said, I cut my hand off in the baler. She says, "Well, I'm not Debbie," and hung up the phone on me. I tried again, and the call didn't go through, so I shut the phone off, turned it back on, and dialed a third time, and I finally got through to my wife, who was able to come and pick me up out in the field.
So, Lowell, what did this mean for your farm?
Well, I was really in a bind. I was unable to use my arm at all. So here we sat wondering, okay, how is all this work going to get done?
You must have been so discouraged.
Well, it is. It's frustrating, depressing. You just, sometimes you don't know what's going to happen. You know something will happen, but in this community, farmers are all busy at that time. They're all getting ready to go in the field, and everything is very weather-orientated, and your timing is limited. You've got the window of time to get out there and get it done. You need to do it.
So what kind of help did you get from Farm Rescue?
Well, they really came in and did about everything. Basically, Bill came with his equipment and volunteers. They put in all the small grains for me, meaning the oats, the wheat, the corn, or not the corn, but the oats, the wheat, the peas, and the soybeans. And they did 740 acres in 48 hours. And that would have taken me probably 2 weeks.
And how were your crops that season?
Wonderful. And if we would have gotten a crop in that window of time, we would have suffered dramatically a reduction in production that year.
So Lowell, how are you doing now, and how is the farm?
The farm is doing very well right now. In fact, it's taken time for me to get used to working with my prosthetic, but I by no means can do everything that I used to do. But with the aid of my wife, who is my right hand right now, we're able to do about everything that's asked of us.
Mm, that's great. Bill Gross and Lowell Hartvigsen, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Bill Gross is founder of Farm Rescue, and he joined us from Seattle. Lowell Hartvigsen is a farmer in North Dakota. To learn more about Farm Rescue, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. In Pakistan, the route through the northwest frontier province to the Afghan border is one of the most dangerous stretches of highway in the country. If you're traveling in that area, local people might encourage you to take along some extra insurance. Will Everett was recently in the provincial capital of Peshawar. He met a street vendor selling just what he needed.
Just on the outskirts of Peshawar, the Board Bazaar is a scene of pandemonium. Travelers squeeze into gaudily painted buses as huge convoys of diesel rigs rumble past in a smoky haze. Everyone here is headed to the Afghan border 40 miles away. The highway runs through the tribal area, where militant activities have stepped up over the past several months. No one seems exactly afraid, but everyone knows that on this highway, anything can happen. In the distance, there's a small boy with a smoking tin can fastened to the end of a long stick. He darts up to an idling taxi, holds the can up to the open window, and blows the smoke inside. The driver gives him a coin and drives away. As I approach the boy to ask what he's doing, he mistakes my long black microphone for a gun and runs away in tears, bringing laughter from those standing nearby. Later in the morning, I meet Yusuf, a man of about 30, who's also approaching vehicles with a smoking tin can. He doesn't run away from my microphone. Instead, he agrees to smoke me. He takes some seeds from a bag and sprinkles them over the red-hot coals inside the tin can. Then he walks around me, holding the can low to the ground so that the smoke spirals upward like enfolding arms. This is an age-old ritual called spilane. According to folk legend, anything that comes into contact with the smoke receives the protective power of the spilane seeds, an herb used in incense. Yusuf has been doing this on and off since he was a teenager.
I have no other means of making a living. Whenever I get a job, I get fired. So this is what I do. My only other option is to become a thief.
Spilane has its roots in Pakistan's pre-Muslim past. When Silk Road caravans would pass through the area, wandering shamans would offer the smoke to traders to protect them from bandits. Today, travelers face similar dangers, but spilane carries over into any area of life where people feel they need good luck.
It's a spiritual thing. People believe if they buy a new car or open a new shop or a new house, they should first smoke it. That way the car isn't in an accident or the house doesn't burn down. The smoke protects them.
Later, Yusuf approaches a battered Mercedes stopped on the roadside. The driver, Salim, is driving to Kabul today. He says that he always gets the spilane treatment before going through dangerous country.
I will be safe from any bad thing later on.
Yeah.
Because of this smoke. So this is a traditional smoke.
You believe this works?
Yeah.
Do you have proof? I mean, have you
seen
it work? Yeah,
I have seen my parents, my elders to do that. So I'm just sticking with this same tradition.
How much did he charge you?
Nothing. Basically, they are just roaming around, and whatever you want, you can give them. They are not charging anything.
Did you give him anything?
10 rupees.
10 rupees?
Yeah.
It's not much, about 8 cents. Yusuf usually makes around 150 or 200 rupees a day, or $2 or $3. Sometimes he gets lucky himself.
A few days ago, two women stopped me to have their car smoked. They were going to be driving in a dangerous area and wanted protection. So I smoked their car and they gave me 200 rupees.
I ask him if he ever considers giving himself the spilane treatment. It's something he's never considered. Smiling, he drops a few spilane seeds into the can, lets the smoke wrap around his body, and sets off into the noontime traffic. looking for more business. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Peshawar, Pakistan.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter and producer living in Texas. And that brings us to the end of our show today. We leave you now with some more music by Nation Beat. You can hear the band on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And of course, you can hear the whole show there or download a podcast so you can take us with you. Our radio team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Chris Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepard, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.